this is Katrina, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Hey, everybody, it's Katrina Chester with Zooming in the Lens podcast, and today is the 17th podcast, and I'm lucky enough to have my very close satsang member and friend, Kara Evans, with me today, and a special guest, Alexa Pellegrino.
I didn't get a trumpet.
No, that was a double trumpet. Her trumpet was for her, and I trumpeted for you.
Okay, thank you.
It was really supposed to be a conch shell to signify the start of our battle. The battle of the game of incarnation, part two. Two. So, yes. I don't know if you tuned in for one, but if you didn't, stop right now. And go listen to part one. Rewind. And we'll wait here for you. Ready? Go. And we're back. So this is part two because Kara and I had stuff that we wanted to still kind of talk about. And we kind of ran out of time. So we wanted to come back and talk about it. So like in a little recap of it, I brought up the topic of being the scientist of your own spirituality, and at the same time was inferring things like we tend to, you know, some people tend to make science about facts and forgetting all the work that goes into the years and years and decades sometimes of research to when we just get delivered results. And I connected it to how similar it is really at its core to the spiritual journey, everybody's journey into understanding themselves more and learning how to cultivate a witness and create awareness, shift perceptions, look at life through different lenses. And we had sort of outlined the recipe for how science approaches a subject. And that they test the subject out and they replicate in different labs. They take it out into the world and they study. They study the object. And it's a lot like what we do in spirituality. And for, I don't know, everybody's journey is different. It's very individual. I'll just speak from mine. There was a bunch of years there where I didn't know that I was the subject. And my spirituality remained this elusive idea. And so what I tended to do was make the mind the bad guy. And because I didn't really understand what was meant by the heart, I tended to push that away too and just deem it like woo-woo or, you know, really inside, what was that? That was me being self-critical because I couldn't get it and my mind wanted to get it. So instead of that, I pushed externally away from it. And so I think what we were proposing, Kara, and please just interrupt me and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I was proposing was that we can see ourselves as the object or the subject. It depends on which lineage you're really going to go through the lens on, but how can we use that scientific model, which has been done, you know, many times before, as our path to find separation, to then come back together as one in our mind, in our body, in our soul, and find self-study through maybe a kinder place. And I liked the recipe. And I think we left off that episode with a Krishnamurti quote, which was all about the observer It was him talking about that when he looks at his wife, he's looking at her already with a preconceived prescription for who she is and how she does things. And so he's saying that basically we're arriving in every moment with people with the memory of them. And you'll find that to be true, really. It's not that you stop doing that. Like, we're all allowed to be ourselves and be in our personalities. We're going to talk a bit about that today. It's just that you're also cultivating something else that's observing that. Oh, I can observe that I'm arriving here in this podcast knowing that I'm doing a podcast, and I can also just, like, be in the podcast as well. And I know it sounds like hippy-dippy. What the hell does that mean? If you've tripped on acid before, there's no explanation needed right now. But if you didn't trip on acid, just remember when you were little and you were playing with your stuffed animals and your Barbies and you used your imagination.
Or your G.I. Joes. Let's be politically correct.
Yeah, like, how self-absorbed am I, right? I'm thinking all girl stuff. Absolutely. I played real estate. That's what I did. Why? Because my mother was a real estate agent. So that's as deep as it got, really, for me. So I loved what Krishnamurti said, because he was trying to talk about how scary it could be to look at each other and arrive in the moment rather than arriving in the memory of that person. And I agree with that. It is scary, because when you meet somebody, the brain is constantly trying to figure things out. That's what it does. It's a great thing. And you don't have to make the... It's not like we're making the brain bad to make the soul good and the heart good. It's all usable, and it's all can be brought into awareness, and you just arrive at the level that you're at.
He's using his memory of her as what he knows, what's familiar.
The comfort zone.
Showing up in the moment is hard to erase what you already know. We do that. If the people listening or want to relate that to something I think happens to everybody all the time, is if you work with somebody or go to school with somebody or befriend somebody even that just really rubs you the wrong way, just something about them just really bothers you. Then you go home and you think about it and you get to that place of maybe compassion. You really want to go in tomorrow or face them the next time with a pure soul and start over. But as soon as you think of them and you see them, that something still bothers you. It's like that memory. It's like that auto memory. Mm-hmm. So hard to just show up right now like you were never there with that person, whoever they are, before.
And I don't think you need to. Like, you don't walk in and go, I'm going to erase everything and arrive in the moment. You're already fucked.
Yeah.
You're already screwed at that point. You say, that is what cultivating the witness, it happens and evolves over time. And at first it feels like you might be a bit schizophrenic, but we all have these many sides to us inside our mind. We're listening to it all day. The commentator, the judger, the strong one, the weak one. I'm just saying, you know, we could bring that into awareness. And you don't have to put it on. You don't have to stand at the door and say, okay, everything erased. It sounds like that.
Well, that wouldn't be a cultivation. That would just be like an activation.
You got it.
It takes more time than to just turn it on like that.
Very well said. So who's speaking right now, for those who don't know?
I'm Lexi.
She's Lexi, and Lexi is my oldest sister. Did I say oldest?
Yes,
she's my oldest. I'm just doing that to bother her right now. She's my oldest sister's baby, but she's not a baby.
But am I?
Well, what are you?
I'm a baby.
You're 26?
Don't tell the world that.
No?
No.
Oh, please.
I wish the world was listening to Zooming in the Lens podcast, but I don't think the world is. Maybe a couple hundred people, but...
Okay, I'm 26. I can deal.
What was the problem with that?
I'm just cultivating my witness.
Oh, okay. And the witness is obviously no age, so...
Right, yeah. Exactly.
By the way, she's really sarcastic. Her sense of humor is very dry, and that is one of the reasons why I love her. So, Lexi, we asked her to be here today because she's been on a journey for years now. And her journey recently has taken her to the mountains in Idaho, where she was leading a bunch of teenagers.
Youth.
Oh, okay.
I was leading youth.
Youth. Is that the appropriate word for it? Yeah.
Politically correct?
Yeah.
Politically correct, thank you.
We love politically correctness.
Yes. So she was leading a bunch of youth in restoring trails, sometimes 83 miles deep from civilization or gas stations. So she's been living off of the earth for the past 7 weeks or so, which might not sound like a big deal to some people out there that are doing that, possibly, but the last few years she's also been in Africa twice, leading groups, dealing with tribes and elephants, and she's just she's a seeker and she's a yogi. And Kara and I love her deeply, and she just got back from her last adventure last night, late at night. And I was excited we were doing this podcast today on the game of incarnation, because I think that we can pick her brain and learn a thing or two about how she's using what she's doing in life to cultivate her witness and her awareness and her shifts of perception. So
it's so interesting to me to have that introduction followed after talking about how these memories of people is like how we define them.
Isn't that ironic?
Because now I'm like defined to everybody who could be listening and to you two as this memory of who Lexi is.
But you don't know that. Maybe it's an individual thing, right? So maybe everybody out there is going, okay, that's what is an element of Lexi's incarnation, but it doesn't mean that any of us know Lexi's heart.
Oh, I would hope that that's what people are thinking.
Well, we can only be it, right?
Yeah.
Can't preach it. Can't do it. You just be it.
So those are just things that my incarnation have done.
Exactly.
But it doesn't define me.
Right. Right. I think we all want that, right, Kara? Like,
yeah.
I mean, if people look at my life and your life and what we've lived up until now.
Right.
I think until you practice it yourself and you can feel that way, like, about yourself, like Lexi just said, this is just my incarnation. If we don't feel that way about ourselves, we're going to be maybe unable to see other people like that.
Sure.
You feel like that, Kara?
I had a really crazy experience on Saturday. Ooh. About in that vein, because I think, you know, we're all here on a journey, and that changes all the time, what we're doing and what direction we're going in, what we think, where we are now, whether it's in the woods and the mountains and Africa. Next week you could be a library teacher, right?
Sure.
I mean, so I was working an event on Saturday, helping a friend. I was on site for 12 hours, set it up, dealt with the bar mitzvah mother. It was a big deal. It was at this exclusive country club, and all the people that were there and attending were in the, you know, multi-million-dollar earners, you know,
racket,
just showing up with their designer stuff. And I don't have I'm not envious of that. I'm usually pretty comfortable with what I'm doing at the moment and, you know, just trying to make sense of my life. Happy to be there, grateful to have the work, enjoying myself. And then someone walked in that I knew.
Whoa.
A guest.
Whoa, what a shift.
how you want to check yourself. My heart started racing. I did not want to see her.
Wow.
And I didn't know why at the moment, but I left.
You left?
I left. I went in my car.
Oh,
I
left?
I left.
Whoa.
Went over to the club manager. I said, everything's done and set. The guests seem to be coming in a little earlier than expected. I lit half the candles, and I'm just not feeling well. And it was like 15 minutes early, but I did not want to have any contact with that person. And I got in my car, and I'm feeling this whole physical thing, like, you know. And I just had to, you know, dig into that for a couple of days because it was really a bizarre thing. So, like you said, that's your incarnation. It's not who you are.
Right.
I'm proud of who I am, but in that moment, whoever was showing up in that moment did not want to, you know, speak to this person who seemingly was this, you know, person in a higher society and a different social rank.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who she is, Lexi. She could be the most miserable, sad person suffering deeply inside. But I didn't even want to face her and say, yeah, you know, I'm working in my black, you know, I'm working at this job.
Right.
And, you know, you're a guest at $500 a plate. Mm-hmm. I felt so off base, and I had all these thoughts, you know, embarrassment, and really, you know, it was a strange place to be. So,
wow. I'm so
gotta be good in your skin when you can, but when you're not, if you could check it right away, cultivate that witness and say, who was that and what is wrong with you?
Well, maybe a little kinder, right?
Yeah, I was kinder to myself, but I thought it was really interesting trying to figure out who that was in that club that had like a anxiety attack and had to leave. It was really interesting.
It's like I always like to think of that when that happens to me. Do you remember the cartoons where they would be in the middle of something and then they would draw a cartoon of a giant fat arrow and it would just be blinking?
Yes.
That's what if I was in that situation and I was in my car, it's this giant arrow that's blinking that is saying, if you were wondering where you're still caught, here you go.
Yeah. Oh my God, it was screaming. My voice was screaming at myself.
Right.
What's wrong with you? You know. But it happened.
It happens. It happens. I mean, I do wish, because I think it would be a lot easier, and I don't think practice is easy. I think it would be a lot easier if there was this perfection that we were all going for. But there's not. There's not a, well, just show me what I'm going for.
No.
There's nothing and no one, because you are completely individual in your own incarnation, doing your own thing, having your own experiences. And that doesn't mean that you're separate from the oneness. It depends on what you believe. It depends on where you're at. But in the incarnation, it's so alluring that we all very much feel separate. We're looking out through these eyes, and you're in your body, and you're in your body, and I'm in my body, and I've got my life, and I look at Kara's or Lexi's, and I could go, their life is fantastic, or their life is horrible, I don't want to be in that life, or wow, it looks great, I do. And those are those moments of arrows sort of pointing down, saying, like, this is the both of them. Just like when we started talking about that you don't have to stand at the door and go, okay, time to be spiritual, clear your mind. None of that, as Lexi had said, it's not a, what was the word you used?
It's not an activation.
That's right. It's a cultivation.
It's a cultivation.
Yeah. And so because of that, everybody cultivates in different ways with different things. And I find it really hard when you first start to make that shift from it's his fault, her fault. Well, if they weren't, so this. It's not the situation for me. To switch from that realm, that level, where everything's about everybody else, and we blame, and we don't even know we're blaming at the time. If you agree with me at the time, I just will label you somebody that gets it. You know? You really understand me, or you get it. And if you don't agree with me, you're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And I think we can literally live an entire lifetime in that place. And basically, we're digging a hole, grabbing other people in with us, metaphorically, and then blocking it up with bricks. And yeah, so spiritual practice, as Krishnamurti said, it is a little bit scary. I mean, he wasn't saying the practice is scary. He's saying observing can be scary, because to see everything as new and let the experience speak for itself and to define each other and our relationships and the things we do and the work we do, to define it in a new way instead of just from the mind. We're just including, what does it feel like? Like, you know, think about it. When we're blaming other people, which we all do, when we're blaming other people, well, it was his fault because, I mean, I'm currently doing it right now, not in this podcast. I mean, it's all your fault.
What I do?
I'm currently doing that with a situation that I have going on right now, that it's this person's fault or their fault or whatever for why this is happening or that is happening. And I am seeing that, but the longer I allow myself to be in that, the more I can't see out of it. So I get this almost visceral feeling that of like amnesia, where I forget completely that I can look at this and realize my part in it, realize that I had expectations, obviously, because how can somebody let you down if you don't have expectations? The right or wrong is even an expectation. So I'm dealing with that right now and find it really alluring, because then all of a sudden you meet with your satsang or your sangha, your community, people that, you know, are practicing and being willing to seek something other than just the answer the mind needs to have and has and thinks it has. And you know, I hear myself then going, wow, I'm really asleep in that moment or it with that person in particular. You know, and I think that's maybe what you're saying here, is that you were working and then in a flash you were asleep in that moment and just felt the shame of it and then retreated.
You know, one of the things in the beginning of this podcast, when we said we're going to compare spirituality and science and how parallel in a lot of things that I've been reading, how I think the consensus that I've read is that Buddhism is the best example of that, combining of those two things. And I literally felt my body go into like a fight or flight. I felt it. Whoa. Which, even though that is a spiritual, you know, it's a terminology they use a lot in philosophy and therapy, it is also scientifically based, the data that comes from all of the things your body goes through when you're having a fight or flight moment. And I felt them.
What'd you feel?
I felt my breathing shorten. I felt my heart rate increase. I felt my blood literally coagulating. Like, you know, I did. I felt like, you know, like you get in that defensive mode. Like, I felt all of that in such a short period of time. I don't even think it was seconds that I you know, made a beeline, got my, collected my things, said my goodbyes, and like made my exit, all based on, I probably was just projecting an outcome of what would have happened had I spoken to this person. You know what? There's a likelihood I would have gotten a big hug. She would have been happy to see me. We could have caught up for a few minutes and she'd have gone to her party. I would have finished lighting my candles, but I decided the outcome before anything happened. I set the whole script of the way that would turn out and got completely defensive and bolted out of there. And I know what I did because I look back on it right away. I caught myself in it. I didn't deny what happened, but it was really interesting how I reacted in that moment, though.
Is it a benefit of your practice that you were able to slow down enough to feel your blood, to feel your heart rate? Like, is that normal for you? Have you always been able to do that? Because that's
No, not always at all. It's that lately, maybe the last year or two, in all the situations, like in the expectation mode, when you, listen, the stress that you feel in your life, well, David G says that it's a reaction to not getting what you want.
David G is a teacher that you've recently went on a lecture with, yeah?
Yes, and I'm still reading through his book back and forth, but that's his definition of stress. It's the body's reaction to not getting what it's looking for in terms of a response. And stress is the condition of that fight or flight that you feel. And he said that that happens to us 8 or 10 times a day. Mm. How we react to it is the difference. But I think even before I read him or met him or any of that stuff, I've been a little bit more aware of all of those things for myself. Yeah. When I have expectations, when I don't get the response that, you know, you set yourself up for it, like you said. Why would you be upset with someone that didn't react a certain way if you already didn't expect them to react that way?
Right.
But we're human, that's why.
Of course, yeah. So we need the tools, discuss the tools, create the tools, you know, take it from other people that have done it. Maybe what works for somebody doesn't work for somebody else. But that really works for me, too. And it took quite a while for me. There is a teacher named Reggie Ray, who's in the Vajrayana Buddhist lineage. And I was doing it before him, but then, you know, somebody comes along, it could be anybody, it could be a guy at a gas station, and he says something that cements it in a different way. But had you not had the time before that, maybe it wouldn't have cemented it with that one word. But what he had talked about were these steps in meeting anger. And it was slowing down your exhale, which is definitely a great thing to do in your body, because the exhale is releasing things and you want to start to slow that down more if you're starting to get anxiety. And you are questioning anger, meaning, like Krishnamurti said, we see people and we have the memory of that person and the brain goes boom, 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 there's Kara, boom, 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 let me fill in the blanks for you. It's almost like the best assistant in the world. You know, I used to have an assistant in the music industry that would whisper in my ear when we did meet and greets somebody's name. You remember her? She was from Cleveland, Ohio. And it wasn't because I didn't have a great conversation with her or she wasn't memorable. Of course she was. It was that I don't have the greatest memory, firstly. And because I was in a bit of fight or flight as well. I think the fight or flight is a gift, for sure, even though that gift has worked against me at least 90% of my life, that fight or flight feeling. But what is the word anger? And where we go to is memory, just like we were talking about. And so I found that I was thinking anger much more than I was feeling anger. Thinking is different, as we all know, than feeling. But what happens is if I don't stand in that moment after, you know, practice when I'm not in that moment is what got me to there. I can't just do it when I'm angry or do it when I'm, I have to create, cultivate space, how to create space, which is what practice really is, you know, at the brass of it, you know, at the tool brass of it, as humans. Creating space so that when that emotion comes up, we already are seeing a similarity in that fight or flight reactionary thing. Oh, a friend comes over and you always greet her this way. So, bam, she walks in the door, you greet her that same way. To just slow down a minute and start with those things before you get into a place of anger, strong emotions that put you to sleep, let's say. And then when you get to anger, you already have been questioning. And it brings me to this place of, what is anger? Where is it? Where is it located in my body? Or am I just going to keep reporting in my mind, that makes me so angry, oh, that bitch, or this, or that, or that.
Yeah.
Like, you're in the thought, and you're listening to the reporter, the commentator, your two, you know, whatever you want to call it. That's probably the best lecturer each of us individually have ever heard, is our own commentator. So you listen to that, and it stops the journey deeper into, what does anger feel like? And for a while, you'll say anger feels horrible, or anger feels this, or anger feels that, and then I can't do it without community or friends. There's just no way for me to sit here by myself. So, you know, I actively practice cultivating this, whether it's like in group classes or Zooming in the Lens, the course, or friends, or you guys, the podcast, where we have these conversations, and all of them are just reminders of everything we all already know. And that reminder of, anger is a word. Yes, it has a meaning that we're all using, that we all have agreed upon, that anger means this. But find out for yourself. When I go deeper into what anger is, for myself, it's different in any given situation, at least on the surface. And then I invite myself, you know, obviously I don't send myself an invitation or anything like that, but it's an invitation, that moment, to ask myself, what does anger feel like? Where is it in my body? You follow it. It might be a crazy place for you. It could be a big toe. It could be your heart. It could be your neck where you get tense. It doesn't have to be an externally physical feeling either. Doesn't have to be that it's a pain. Oh, I can identify it as pain. It doesn't have to be identified as pain. Maybe anger feels good. Maybe you feel anger and you're like, no, I like this high. This dopamine and adrenaline high. But it creates a different relationship to words in general. The game of incarnation has to include language. It has to include words, because we're all agreeing on words. We're all agreeing that certain things are called certain things. So, you know, the Krishnamurti quote that I had, you know, we had finished the last podcast on, was about how he's willing to see his wife in a different way. And through that willingness, through questioning everything, he was able to see how much of his wife he wasn't seeing, and how much of us as humans want to possess. We were talking about that before. My husband, my wife, those titles.
Yeah, before you go on to that. So what did you come up with. What does anger feel like to you? Do you have an answer for yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I do with what I've been working with now. With what I'm working with now, I do. You could probably ask me in another set of time, and it might be something different. So I just want to make that clear, because I don't think you pick something and then it just stays with you. You know, you grow with it, and it changes. But what it feels like to me, colors come to mind, because I try not to grab onto just yet more words that define it. So I do colors and I do textures, and I have to close my eyes when I do it, because I otherwise can't feel the feeling. That's just me, but I don't know, you might want to try that. When I close my eyes and I relive the anger, or if I'm in the middle of it, it feels like the shapes of square. It feels like the texture of stucco. I know it sounds weird, but listen, how badly do you want to not be the victim to emotions? And it feels like the color yellow, very, very bright. So I describe it in those ways, and it shifts it. And when I follow it in those new ways, because those new ways are not ways that we have all agreed to describe a word like anger, it's new to me. And because it's new to my mind, it takes me in the direction of the anger. And when I get there, the anger that once felt solid and like a big giant block you would have to really power through, like a football player, like a linebacker, to get through it, becomes transparent. And I go right through it.
Wow. That's great.
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes it sucks, because I get to a certain point and something in me doesn't want to face that. A good practice, I don't think, brings you tons of happiness. I personally have not experienced that. But you having an imagination, to me, is key. If you're too cool or too think you're not cool enough, or you're embarrassed easily with yourself just alone, these things can feel tremendous, like describing an emotion as a shape or a texture or a color. They can feel like that's weird. But then question, it's you alone with you. And that's going to help build up a trust, because it almost feels like you're your best friend at that point. If you could do that with you, believe me, the things that you're doing with yourself that nobody knows you're doing, that you are aware of, are probably a lot stranger than putting an emotion with a color. You know, I mean, if you really, really dig in there, and I mean, that's not the worst thing we're all doing by ourselves. Who cares if it's weird? It really, I mean, if it's that weird that it freezes you and doesn't allow you to do it, you might just not be ready, and that's okay too. When you get to a certain point, man, who cares? I would describe it as anything at this point, because it helps me. When you find something that helps you, I think you start to weigh it out, and it doesn't outweigh the judgment on yourself or others. But find something that works for you.
Well, identify it is really the first thing. Identify the feeling, isolate it. No, that color, naming it, and how descriptive you were is obviously something that somebody trying to work on something won't be able to do on their first attempt.
That's right.
It's just the opening yourself to the awareness of it is the first. Admitting you have a problem is the first step to getting help.
Thank you. We are now turning Zooming in the Lens to AA.
AA.
Yeah, I that's what you were doing in the car For sure, Kara. Yeah, you addressed it. I mean, didn't it almost feel like as you were packing up stuff and walking to your car that you were, like, out of body because you knew you were doing it?
I was, like, speed walking. I was 100% aware the whole time.
Isn't that bizarre, though? Like, you're both the walker and the witness of the walker.
And the judge. I was judging myself. I was doing it all in one time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the beauty of this whole thing here, is that we all do get to show up as we are. You know, like I said, there's, you don't look in the dictionary and see, like, spiritual practice or faith or perfection. It's just, it doesn't exist. And if that exists, it's just another technique to make you feel separate. You know, the thing I always try to remember that stays with me when I try to, when I use these tools, is that anything that's in time, anything that's using the mechanisms of time, is always going to change. Because it's time itself that is giving us cement blocks on our feet. Because then we don't want change, then we don't want this. Time is not an enemy. And it's not, I don't even think it's a gift. I think it just is. It's a mechanism that we're all using to not be late and meet each other. Because really, nature is taking care of that for us, you know? Nature is taking care of that. I mean, I'm obviously talking about the mechanism of, like, a clock or a watch right now, but when it's nighttime, it gets dark. And the sun goes, I'm on duty, I'm going down, I'm off duty, I'm going down, and the moon says, I'm on duty, and comes up.
Not everywhere.
No, not everywhere. Like Alaska and Sweden and...
Yeah, so it just, it's even more proof that it just really doesn't matter.
Well, no, I think
time is so irrelevant.
If we went to those places, though, I bet you that there are other ways in which nature tells you what time it is.
It's our physical body.
Yeah, well, I told, when I came back from Vegas and I said to Tyler, like, it's just strange to have to reset. I know it's only 3 hours, but... At some points of the day and time, the 3 hours, you know, when I was at a party, when I got out there at midnight, my body said it was 3 a.m. Now, midnight to 3 a.m, you know, when your body is sleeping at that time, mm-hmm. it's only because that's what the time tells you to do when you're here, mm-hmm. when you're home. I mean, because it's nighttime, this, like you said, the sun goes down. What do? We wind up our day. We get in our pajamas. We go to sleep. Why?
Yeah.
Why do we do that? Why isn't it opposite for us?
Well, and why don't we question it? I don't care if we do it. It's just like, why doesn't anybody question it? It's the same reason why nobody questions, like, who is inside me? Am I really just this body?
Well, we're questioners, aren't we? Tyler's a questioner.
There's a good handful of people who are questioning.
My son is a questioner.
I see. I was speaking for the general public.
I'm sorry. My son, Tyler, is 22 years old, and he is a questioner. And he believes in those things, like we just said. Well, you sleep in the night, and you're awake in the day because that's what everybody else does.
Science says that... That's the best time.
He gets up in the morning and he goes to eat, and, you know, he'll be eating something, you know, whatever, chicken or tacos left over from the night before, and I'll say, why are you eating that for breakfast? He's like, it's just a meal. I'm hungry. Like, does it have to be a Pop-Tart or a bowl of cereal? Why is that? Because that's the way we were taught... Diseases are bad, and eggs are for breakfast, and
yes,
you sleep when it's dark out.
Isn't it just the same as not being willing to describe your anger as a color or a shape? Because that's not how we describe anger. Right. That's too weird. That's too out of our comfort zone.
Right.
Yeah, it's all the same concept.
Yeah, and I think it's really important too. To say that it's not because we're trying to be rebellious. Like, we're not going, this world, I'm going to do everything opposite. I mean, yeah, I was that kid. I was definitely that teenager punk, you know, New York era stuff. Angst and all that. Never, I think all teenagers have that in their own way, but it's not really the point. It's the point isn't to just go, I'm going to do the exact opposite. It's just to question it and know that just because we're all doing something doesn't make it right.
It's a more evolved angst.
Yeah, right, right. Or just because everybody's doing something doesn't mean it's right or wrong. Like, yeah, we're really hooked on this. Like, what's the right thing to do? What's the wrong thing to do? Well, I'm scared to make a decision because I don't want it to be the wrong one. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the constant search for perfection. Because if you're going to claim that something is right or wrong, then you're looking at being perfect, even if it's just in that moment or that decision. So what
is the decision maker? Who's the one that states if it's right or wrong?
It depends,
society.
Right? Yeah. Family. Yeah.
Well, people are definitely never afraid to give me their opinion. That's for sure.
No. No.
Whether or not you want it or ask for it.
That's right. So, Lex, tell us how you, in the mountains, you know, because, like, how do you use that as your practice? And what did you, I mean, you're so fresh off it. It's less than 24 hours since you, your hands are still coated with dirt that you cannot get rid of. Nor maybe would want to even at this point. She's got signs all over her body of nature and the hard, hard work that she was doing out there. And we haven't had a lot of, a huge chance to talk and catch up, but I'd love to know where your head's at since getting off.
In relation to what we were just talking about?
I guess in relation to the game of incarnation, like what you went up there to do, and in the end, what sort of moments did you have and what were you aligning and grounding to?
I think a lot of it is just so directly related to stepping outside of our normality and comfort zone that it just throws you like a whole new swirl of concepts that are, it's just, you know, a different lifestyle. You know, you're sleeping on the ground every night, you're eating things that I don't even really know what they're made out of.
You're trying to
cold for them. Breakfast every day. Yeah, it's, you know, I'm not waking up to eggs and bacon. It's taking me 30 minutes to start a fire and boil water just to have a cup of coffee on my way to work, which is hiking. It's not driving. So it's like you're just throwing a curveball at everything that you know in a society, and then you throw in like 10 teenagers who this is probably their first job. And it's with that addition, it's not only stepping outside of your comfort zone, but as an adult, it's throwing in this like hint of childness. I don't know what the right word would be for that.
Childlikeness?
Like youthness, that it rubs off on you. So as frustrating and as annoying it can become, it's also really refreshing. And it helps you as someone who's not like in that mindset of a 16-year-old anymore. It brings you back to that. And I find myself swinging an axe and cutting a tree down while at the same time singing songs from SpongeBob.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So it takes me like a woman who is not notoriously known for being in this line of work. So I have that facet, and then I have a bunch of teenage boys with me. So I'm like just completely thrown out of what's comfortable, what's known, what's common, what's expected. Mm-hmm. And then I get to hang out with a bunch of kids.
So playing.
Yeah. It's all playing.
Yeah.
I mean, every day I wake up and I get to play in the mud.
Right.
And But at the same time, I have to have a level of professionalism. I have to create that stability for the youth to be able to thrive and learn the things that we're trying to teach. Every night, I'm teaching an hour-long class about environmental law or the nature that's surrounding us or how to deal with wild animals or how to build a campfire or how to pack a backpack. So there's a lot of different areas that are included in it. But I think for me, I come away every time feeling like when you re-enter yourself back into society after any extended period of time doing this, it's always such a bizarre feeling, like everything else has just been kind of operating here. And I've removed myself, and now I'm coming back with this whole new set of skills and perceptions and ideas. So I almost, like, in a few weeks, it'll probably wear off, and I'll be back on my iPhone, like, you know, doing all this societal stuff, and I'll know about all the new commercials and all those things. But I have a few weeks now where I'm like, almost I get an outside aerial view of society again.
Wow.
So it removes you for a little bit, and then you come back and your mind is still removed, but now my physical body's back. And it's like a game of catch up. And that, so I come out with like this feeling of pride, but also this feeling of like, whoa, am I running away from this society? Like, am I using this as a way to just escape from everything? And then I also have the like, no, because I'm helping these youth to create their future and take control of their lives.
You mean because this doesn't look like a day job?
Right.
I see.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I come away with mostly is a sense of pride. Also, a really overwhelming gratefulness for the luxuries we have, especially in this country.
Oh, yeah.
It just really helps you.
What is the youth group that you are guiding or playing with, however you want to look at it? What are they? What's their motivation to be there? What's the organization? Why do they go?
It's really individual. I'd say probably a majority is their parents making them or having the idea for them and then guiding them to do it.
Because of, I'm just, for you, it's like it's a learning and growing, but it's also teaching because of your, where you've come to and your searching and your adventuring and all the things you've accomplished has been selfless acts of giving back and doing good for the communities and for the earth. But in this case that you're leading a group of youth, I feel like there's probably something about this society that you're just kind of easing your way back into that they've been removed from for a reason beyond their control. If that makes sense.
Oh, that's interesting element. I think I know where you're going with that, is that this was Lexi's choice, but how do these kids show up when they're being forced to show up?
Right, because maybe they couldn't properly function, or and properly meaning conform to what society expected of them at 16.
Right.
For the same reason, when my brother was 16, my mother said, I'm turning you into the police. He did some small, minor, whatever, misdemeanor. And she said, it's the police or the army. She couldn't deal with him anymore. So is that where they're at? Some place where they're not moving forward with what is expected of them at their age?
I don't really know if I can generalize because I have only had one crew, and there are so many youth who have done this in the past and are still that I haven't experienced. But for the specific group that I was working with, a majority sort of are along those lines of a path in their teenage years where they couldn't thrive in traditional a traditional high school or educational system setting, which I wish I would have known about when I was their age, because traditional high school and the way that we do standardized testing and lecture-driven courses, it doesn't work for a lot of us.
No, but if they're given an alternative option like that,
right,
which I think is fantastic to connect with the earth and go on experience like that where you don't have the luxuries that these 16-year-olds have today. Mm-hmm. And they really do have to check in with where they are in their gratitude. They don't really have a choice in that environment. I think that it's really healthy. And the ones that don't have that option and that option's not available to them probably go down a really hard path for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. And a lot of the time they get there and they reject it and they push it away and they get really angry at authority or at themselves or just at their parents and the situation that they found themselves in. But I think that a lot of the time they really surprise themselves with how much they can do. And as a core member a few years ago, I definitely surprised myself. Spending 6 months in the backcountry, I got there and totally rejected it and pushed away the whole idea and didn't think I would be able to do it. I mean, talk about judging yourself, like, for the first few months, that's all it was.
Wow.
But then you eventually get to a point where you're like, wow, this actually interests me. I'm actually finding myself paying attention to what these people are teaching me. And I never would have thought that anything having to do with nature or wild animals or environmentalism would ever interest me. But, and it might not in a few years, they might not care about the field at all. But I think the way that it's run and giving them the opportunity to have a lot more responsibility is what they really get excited about it. And it really helps them to get more interested in doing it. And then it pushes aside those feelings of dis-ease and being uncomfortable. You start to kind of cope and realize that comfort is really relative. Mm-hmm. Once you can overcome that mind telling you, this sucks.
Right.
I don't like being cold. I don't like waking up and having snow on my tent. Mm-hmm. I don't like eating these gross noodles.
There's so much yoga in that, Lexi.
Oh,
so
my,
much
it
yoga.
All is.
It's all.
And then also there's a beautiful shift of seeing the work we're doing as digging tread or trail to creating a piece of art in this living environment that hosts a whole society of living beings. I mean, coming together and really not just using nature as a place to get away from a city or a 9-to-5 job, but using it as our home that we're there taking care of and we're in a symbiotic relationship with.
Because it's taking care of you.
Absolutely.
Right.
And you, the constant thought of, if I do this the wrong way, I could wake up to a grizzly bear sniffing around my tent. Or if I do this the wrong way, my house is going to become infested with mice.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to the appreciation and the focus on every little thing that you're doing and doing it not only with integrity, but with love.
Absolutely.
Oh.
I really do. I think it's fantastic.
And I think in a way,
that's consciousness, right? That's you're being conscious and look, right. You come back here now. And the great thing is that you don't come back here now and say, oh my God, everybody's screwed up and society's screwed up. You're just able to look through a lens now of how this incarnation is so alluring. And because everything is at least easier than that, at least in the West, at least if you have a shelter. But if we learn from you that awareness and we treated our lawns, our water, our plumbing,
our food,
what we put in our mouth, everything as if we do this wrong, a grizzly bear might come.
Or if we just don't treat this with respect in general.
Absolutely, absolutely. But that feeling of, it's not just about me.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, everything is teamwork. Everything is a community. And the more that we can look at each other and the world around us as one big community, I mean, the more we'll thrive. Like, it's obvious in my eyes. It's right there in front of us. Yet we do get so caught up in, this is my family. Right. These are my friends. That's even horrible. Even in the situation that I'm in, a lot of the youth can get caught up in, this is my crew. Ah. And the other crew doesn't matter.
Right.
So it's a constant push of like, no, we're here together. We're all in this for the same reason.
And you don't have the distractions that we all have here of, I'm not happy with that situation, so I'll just call another friend, or I'll put on the TV, or I'll, you know, whatever. You don't have those distractions. So in essence, it's you're physically and metaphorically removing yourself to get a better view. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that you're high up on a mountain looking down. And the thing about the mind and letting it be the master is that that is what separates us. And so even going into the program, you had the awareness of feeling separate. And slowly but surely, as you realign and you cultivate the witness, and you watch yourself and remember what you came from, you are not feeling so separate.
Right.
And that is spirituality.
Well, and the golden part for me is just planting that little bit of a seed in these youth.
Oh, wow.
Who may have never had any exposure to any kind of spirituality. And I think a lot of them, going back to the conversation of doing weird things, like the colors for anger and all the different representations, taking them out of the comfort zone area, so much so that we can try to, what's the word I'm looking for? Suggest those things and not push them, but to put them out there for use. And there are a lot of things that we do that are weird, and take those ideas of, I don't want to look stupid when I do this, I don't want my crew to judge me for saying this or acting like a monkey to play this weird game.
Right.
And it I think for me, a lot of the time, it's not a matter of whether or not I can describe something as a color or an emotion as a color, but it's just doing the weird thing. Like, that's the step.
Yeah, totally.
Is getting myself to say, okay, I can look stupid right now.
Yes.
And right. Then when I get to that point, it's like a blossom happens. And, right. And it just puts you on a whole new level of, well, if I could do that.
Right.
And I could just do anything. Exactly. It doesn't really matter.
That's right, because we're not living in an ashram.
Right.
We do have distractions, and to cultivate the tools of how to allow freedom to feel like you did on that mountain, I do think it helps when you've either met a lot of suffering and you want to get off the roller coaster of the mind constantly delivering the same thing to you, or you remove the distractions. And I think you're explaining it perfectly in that it's not about what you're doing, it's doing something different. Mm-hmm. If every time you feel angry, you're doing this, just try something else. Because that feeling that you get when you try something else, whether it's going and doing what you're doing, or it's saying, instead of just eating this, I'm going to actually think about the animal and send gratefulness to it while I'm eating it, or I'm going to chew 20 times, or I'm going to gaze at one point. I think the last podcast you had talked about candle gazing. Something different.
Because doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result is what?
Insanity.
Exactly.
Insanity.
So if you're looking for anything different in your life in any way, in your emotions, in your relationships, just take a different approach one time.
Even if it's just using a different hand to brush your teeth in the morning.
Yeah, that's a big one for me.
Like, just something tiny can do so much for you.
today in my yoga class, the teacher said, I'll invite everybody to just try something they never tried before. So I'll offer up, as we're going, an alternative. And, you know, no judgment. If you do, you do. If you don't, you don't. If you fall, you fall. If you choose not to. But I just want to just suggest that if you never lifted your leg in that pose, get up on just one big, get up on your toe, you know. Or if you never gaze towards the sky in this pose, turn your gaze up the sky. Like, it's just funny that she said that today, but it's the truth. Like you said, any little thing that you've never done, just see what, you don't know what can open up if you try it.
I like that image of getting up on your toe. I feel like it runs parallel to Lexi being up on a mountain and us all creating space to cultivate the witness, be the watcher and the observer of our mind to get a better look at the game of incarnation. I really do like that view.
And it'd be okay whether you look silly or you fall down or you drop your toothbrush or whatever the result of that action you take that is different for yourself. Just be okay with whatever happens.
Whoever told you that you're supposed to be perfect?
You know, I really love the name, the game of incarnation, because when I think about the experience I just had and that little, like, title or phrase, it's so perfect, because when we're teenagers and we're stuck in that angsty phase of, like, oh, I hated high school, and, like, all I want to do is hang out with my friends, and my parents made me come do this, but it's, like, better than working at Wendy's, so whatever, but I don't really care about your rules. That whole area, it's so serious.
It is so serious.
We get so stuck in that, and even as a leader, like, I found myself getting stuck in, like, oh, I can't deal with this kid. Like, he's so angry all the time and just negative and bringing everyone down. And a lot of the time, the solution for both of us, me and the youth, was to just laugh.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So we'd play games and they'd ask me questions that were so serious, like, I really need to cash my check. Like, how am I going to cash my check when I get out of here? And I'd just be like, oh, dude, like, you got to go to Mexico. Like, we can't cash the checks in the States. It's a nonprofit. Like, they only do that when you got to cross the border.
You're cruel.
And I'd find myself, like, more and more when they got really, like, worried or paranoid about something that I'm like, I got it taken care of. But they don't need to know that. They're freaking out.
Right.
So I'm gonna play on that and make them realize in a fun way, in a joking way, that, like, not everything is so serious. We're out here 86 miles in the backcountry, and you're worried about how you're going to cash your check in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'd be more worried.
Let's go play in the dirt.
Yeah, I guess that's the same amount of insanity as as youth. Or me, or anybody saying, I really need to figure out my retirement fund.
Right, exactly.
That's what it feels like to me. Talk to me when I'm old and homeless, but that's what it feels like to me. It feels like we're just trying to get somewhere and we're missing being here.
We're missing the game. We're missing having fun in it.
We're missing the game. You got it.
And that's why I really like that, because it is such a game. And yes, there are serious parts. There are strategies. But it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, at least we're supposed to know what fun is.
And what it looks like.
Yeah.
And when to have it.
That's right.
So that's a really nice way to put it. And it is an incarnation, absolutely.
Yeah, and I like the phrase, because it also is, like, a lot of ways to define it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the game of incarnation, like, you're it. Like, this is your game.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the game of life, learning to play, Leela. Understanding that you are the scientist, and how you want to experiment with you without creating violence on somebody else and yourself, And I really mean that, especially from a teenage place, because there are a lot of teenagers out there that are creating a lot of violence on bullying, driving their parents this way and that way. And, you know, teenagers and even younger than teenagers, just that concept alone being put into the education system of, like, what it means to serve yourself without hurting others is huge.
Just to even think about
others. Just to even think about it.
At all.
And challenging yourself in ways that might, you know, we're not saying give up your day job right now and go run away. We're saying how can you be looking at your day job through a different lens and using it for practice rather than it using us?
Yeah, absolutely.
This isn't anything new. I like, this has nothing to do with me. This is giant and huge, and you can find it in religious practices.
You can find it in a day job.
You can find it at the ice cream place, at the gas station, at the supermarket, and you can also find it in India and many other countries. It's not about where you go. It truly is about seeing that we are here to play a game. We really are here to play a game. And when we think that the game is being played on us, and we take that perception, feel how closed in that feels. Like, the government's taking me for granted, and there's a conspiracy everywhere. If that's going to inspire greatness in you to feel that way, and you're not trying to spread it and translate it in a way that's creating harm, then absolutely do what you have to do. But what I feel from feeling like there are enemies and there are people that help you and there are people that don't, is that it's the game of time. And in the game of time, I'm usually the victim. And being the victim usually separates me from the ones that I feel are running the show. And that makes me so in the game that I don't know it's a game. Mm-hmm. And I actually think it's about how much money I have, letters after my name, and how good my life looks from my own perspective in my mind. And I don't think you have to forsake that to embark on questioning and self-study at all. It's about meeting other people, like community, that are also in this game of life. And even if you just go, well, I might be in a game of life, but whatever, it feels very serious because I have to bring home the money and I have to feed this person and I am responsible for this. And yes. And there's millions of people that are responsible for how a child is going to survive in a country and in a village that has no food. There's always going to be somebody worse and always somebody better. It's inspiring ourselves. What inspires you? If colors and looking at emotions in that way doesn't, create your own way.
Because you are your own scientist.
Because absolutely you're your own scientist. How could we not be? That doesn't negate God. That doesn't, if anybody out there is saying, well, God plans everything for me, well, just participate then. Participate in the plan God has for you. If everything is planned out and mapped out, and that is what you, the faith that you're in. There's always a way. There's always a way. I can't do it alone. Maybe other people can. You know, I get asked a lot, like, what I think consciousness is. And I found this just great tiny little thing that I wanted to read, who I don't really know who the author is. And quite frankly, I don't really care. If the author's out there and you want to claim this, go right ahead. There could be 10, 20, 30 authors, but I'm finding lately that I find things that I really dig, and I find who the author is, and then I find out that that author took it from somebody else, and that author took it from somebody else, and then it dates back to Greco-Roman times, and I'm like, listen, we all own and don't own all of this material. And I had a friend of mine named Michael that once said to me, you know what, Katrina, you don't have to quote everybody. You don't have to always say, well, this is a quote from Ram Dass or this is a quote from Alan Watts. And I was like, oh, that would be horrible. But it's not mine. And he said, well, eventually you'll see what I'm saying. But if you experience it, you don't worry about the ownership as much. And it doesn't feel like you're plagiarizing or you're ripping somebody off. That very statement that he said to me, I was appalled at. I was appalled at because that was the game that I was in at that moment, that I had to not take credit. It wasn't about me. So I played with that by myself. Not out loud, but by myself. I played with the concept that once I've experienced something, and experience is different than just knowledge or understanding something. I felt like once I experienced it, I could put it in my own way, and even if it comes out word for word for something, that ended up making me feel what another teacher in my past had said to me that I didn't like at the time, which now is so apropos. And I love that turnaround, you know, where you feel like that doesn't make any sense. And then years later, you're sitting here going, actually, it does. So this person used to say, we have to learn how to feel full. Full, not full of shit. Or learn how to feel full of shit. I've got plenty of that too. But feel full. Enough. Everything is enough. I'm full. I've got enough. I'm enough. I've eaten enough. I have enough belongings. I have enough clothes. I have enough knowledge. And I have enough faith. I love that concept now, so thank you to her for that. So I don't know who the author is, and it's only coming from a place of love for me, not from a place of arrogance. In explaining consciousness, two young fish are swimming and they meet an elder fish. The elder fish says, the water is very pleasant today, isn't it? And the elder fish greets them politely. The two young fish, they swim on, and after a while, one of them asks, water? What's water? That's how hard it is to use our language to describe feelings, even though consciousness isn't a feeling. But consciousness is a direct lineage of cultivating the witness. And if we don't experience it, we don't know what we're around. And in the game of incarnation, we get lost. We get lost. Am I the one doing this podcast? Am I the one speaking in this podcast? Or am I the one stepping outside, watching my Katrina personality doing the podcast? You're both. Until you're not. So that you could see yourself in this, and how sometimes teachers, gurus, ministers, rabbis, anybody that is feeling something and desperately from a loving place is wanting to describe it and just sometimes can't. What does consciousness feel like? You don't even know it's there until it's there. Not there as a concept, but having this faith that you know what you're not. I am not this body. I am not this mind. I am not these thoughts. There is not only what I see from just the mechanisms of my eyes. And if you can if you're broaching things like that, you're most likely ready. And it might not be about exactly defining what you are. It might just be about exposing yourself to all of it and finding yourself, literally finding yourself in every ounce of it, and finding yourself, Lexi, as you did in nature. You're grounding to nature. How long did it take you to feel right when you first got there? And I don't know what that right means, you know, like you could define that if right yes, means... Okay.
Yeah. Right. I'm not even sure what it would mean to feel right out there.
I guess once you're over the fight or flight that Kara started this podcast off with, mm-hmm. once you're out of that relative fight or flight of everything's new, how the hell am I going to do this? And I mean, you're way more seasoned than somebody coming out of nowhere and going and doing what you did. But it was a new experience, and you were showing up as a teacher for others while you have to serve yourself too, and learning that that's not a bad thing to serve yourself. Like it's got such a negative connotation, but how can you serve somebody else if you don't even know what serves you and you're not honoring that?
I think it has a relationship, each of those things. Learning from someone else is always constantly learning how to serve someone else. Is always constantly teaching me how to best serve myself.
Yeah.
I think they go hand in hand very much so. I do totally. Think there's a level of needing to serve myself to be able to even do that.
Yeah.
But I think the rightness, I think it's ever growing.
Is it? In like the same there wasn't way. Any one moment where you went, I'm okay.
I'm always reassuring myself of that. Mm-hmm. And I think there are small moments where I feel as if I might not be, but it always turns out that I am.
Yeah.
And I think in that field, there's like a lot of the training helps with those feelings.
Yeah.
But I going even beyond that job that I was doing, or whatever you want to call it, that experience that I had.
Yeah.
It's every day. It's like, I'm okay. It's like that rightness it's different in every day and every moment even.
Yeah.
Out there, out here.
That's what I'm saying. I'm catching what you're throwing down. I know that sounds so 60s, doesn't it? I'm catching what you're throwing down, man. I think that would be a really great thing for all of us to say to ourselves. I'm okay. Like, really... I am okay. I'm okay getting fired. I'm okay feeling horrible cramps. I'm okay with this headache. I'm okay breaking up with this person. I'm okay starting a new relationship. Just that mantra of I'm okay sounds like a brilliant idea, because who is the person saying I'm okay? That might just be the cultivation of the witness. Because if we listen to the mind, I don't know how often your mind tells you you're okay, but I would say that it's taken me a long time, and I've got a lot longer to go before I arrive in every new moment where I'm just okay.
Oh, right. There's constantly moments that you're saying, I'm not okay.
I'm not okay.
And I'm freaking out.
Yeah. Like you start out, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm good. I'm okay. And
I'm
then
right.
You go right into, I'm not okay.
Oh, shit. I'm not okay.
And I hate that. Why did they tell us to say that?
Right.
That's what got me in this place, because I thought I was okay. And okay is not going to pay my bills. Yeah, right. We all have that.
Constantly. It's
right, but the knowledge that you're not okay is not going to pay your bills either.
Right,
and just the awareness of that feels like, well, then why do it?
Well, and the not okay can always be followed up by, and that's okay.
Absolutely, you hit the nail right on it.
Well, you just have to meet yourself where you are,
right,
and okay with it.
Right.
That's right.
Just like you running away from the woman You know, it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kara, did you have anything else that you had pulled that you could share with us before we go?
Probably a lot of different things, but I did just want to talk about, because we didn't really, the whole science and spirituality thing, like really, I dug into that a lot because there's so much to read on it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I realized, even though we talk about it all the time and I read all the time, and I asked you about that book, The Buddha's Brain, which is exactly what that's about.
Yeah.
The parallels that go back in, you know, back to Einstein, I never put them together in the same way that I did in the last few weeks since we really started talking about it. And I just read everything I could on the topic. And how many times in your life did you hear, or maybe I should ask Lexi because she's younger, Einstein's theory of relativity? It's a thing, right? I mean, I've heard the term for that, but I never really read what it meant and how it relates to science and spirituality. And it came, what I read came from a book on Buddhism called Be a Lamp Upon Yourself.
Who's the author?
Unknown. I picked it up at a Buddhist temple. It was an offering. It was a free book.
Oh.
I mean, you know, make a donation there, and you know, they have a lot of literature. I love it there.
Buddhists are great for that.
I know.
I love it.
And basically, the point that they're making just in this, the whole book talks about, so be a lamp upon yourself, another way of saying be a witness to your own life, is how nothing is independent of itself. Everything is related to something else or a result of something else, that a relative, that everything is conditional, relative, and interdependent. Nothing in this world can be regarded as a permanent entity with its own identity. Things are what they are only in relation to other things.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And, you know, of course, it gives example of, you know, a father is a father because of his relationship to his son. Without that other human being, he's not a father. It's just a,
that's
it's
a
just
great
a,
example.
A label.
Yeah.
And
you know, important, but if you're asleep in it, you just end up feeling guilt.
Right. Things are what they are only in relation to other things. And you can really pertain, you know, you can find examples of that in your life all the time.
Absolutely.
Even your emotions.
Totally. Oh, I love that, Kara.
So, that was just one of something I felt interesting. There's something that people could easily relate to, something so simple, yet here's a book that's over 200 pages of, you know, different examples of scientific models in spirituality.
Yeah. Anything that makes us not feel so separate. And that took a long time, too, because I remember when I first heard that years ago, I was like, I don't feel separate. Like, I actually got defensive about it. Separate? Like, but when you hear the different ways on, and you bring that into awareness, let's say, yeah, we all walk around feeling separate. And I don't think we all have to hold hands and sing Kumbaya unless, you know, hey, I have actually done that. It feels pretty damn good.
Because it's a sangha. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
That community.
Listen, I can't get through my days, my life, and my practice without having that sisterhood, you know, what is the Sanskrit word for it?
Satsang?
Satsang, community, group, you know, whatever you want to call it. But somebody to just talk to, you know, say, hey, I feel this way, you know. Either they will be there to support you or give you another insight or tell you you're not crazy or you are crazy and it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So just noticing where we feel separate in life would be a really great tool. Where do we feel separate? Where do we feel apart? I don't mean apart in one word. I mean, where do we feel a part of things? You know, even things like fantasy football. People feel this connection. Sports is a big connection. But we don't see that unless we pull away from it for a second. We think it's about a lot of other things, or I can't speak for anybody. All I know is that if I look at what sports is, my mind will tell me one thing, but my heart tells me another. That desire to be a part of something. All of you are watching this game. All of you are rooting for one team. Is the same as all of us going to a congregation with the same priest or temple with the same rabbi. It's just that when we make one thing good, we tend to make another thing bad. So, you know, starting to connect the dots in our own life to how we're allowing the separation to bring us into maybe depression or feeling shame or feeling guilt. One quote I love, Nietzsche, whatever is done for love always occurs beyond good and evil. Then it doesn't have to be right or wrong. Doesn't need that. That's a conception of the mind. It's almost like we don't have enough faith in what we think is good, so we need to put something in the bad category to inflate the good, like as if it doesn't stand on its own. Can't I have a great friendship with Kara and just say, I love Kara, we're so close and it's ever growing, and end it at that? Or do I have to say, and there's nobody like her, and if there were more Karas, the world would be a better place. I wish I had more friends like Kara. Like, just tiny.
That's going into that whole selfish range.
That's
of mine, not mine.
Dark side.
Yeah.
Why isn't it okay to just say something and let it be enough?
I think it's habit. I mean, a lot of it is just habit. I grew up in an area, well, I mean, same area as you two, but not the same area as anybody listening. But that area for me, and especially my high school years and teen years, was all about that. Cliques, being in, not being in, being so fearful that I was going to get into school and everybody would be mad at me because they will have talked.
I remember that.
It stays with me. It is a feeling inside of me that I'm still yet to not be able to go to. I don't use it as mental dialogue anymore, of course. Well, not of course. I don't. But I could feel the feeling, right? You probably felt the feeling in your stomach.
I could feel that feeling in the pit of my stomach.
When I said it.
Right now, when I think about it. And it was 40 years ago.
That is powerful.
Okay, it was 35 years ago.
Don't be aging yourself even more there, Kara Dollface.
Yeah. Oh, that.
That feeling. But you know what? Left in the dark, locked away, with terms like, I'm a grown-up now, or I don't see those people, or even by saying things, those people don't matter to me now, like, I don't even talk to them, I wouldn't be friends with them today. All of that stuff is our way of creating separation. Even if we just get nicer to the invisible old friends in our mind that we don't talk to anymore, gives you and leaves you with a different feeling for those times.
You mean like the girl I saw at the country club?
Yes. I wasn't going to say it again, but yeah. 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 And, you know, looking at that, Kara, is so juicy to look at that and say, how have I shown up in that way for myself where I don't know? Where I haven't brought that into awareness, or just allowing that to come in and not trying to get those memories to come in. But we all have that.
Was sleeping for a while.
Yeah, you know what? Sometimes it's really nice to be asleep. If it wasn't so juicy to be asleep,
We'd all be awake.
Yeah, I, you know, I guess I'm one of those people that thinks that that is why we're here. To fall asleep and wake up and fall asleep and wake up over and over and over again until we just don't anymore. And why can't that just be good enough? Acceptance, like all of us just accepting ourselves. Getting rid of that word perfection and seeing it through the lens of a game of incarnation. There's a lot of really great philosophies out there that interpret the game of incarnation, the game of life, in other ways too. So go out there and research it. Just type it in and see all the different things that come up. These are just things we're playing with right now, but the game of incarnation was able to translate to Alexa in her, you know, mountain journey, and you can take that with you and use it. How am I participating in the game? How am I adding to the game? How am I waking up in the game? How am I asleep in the game? What does the game represent to you? I mean, there's so much juice in there, right? So, with that, the Zooming in the Lens course, I think, if we're able to air this podcast tomorrow, which would be Wednesday, what, the 20th? 21st of October. If you're hearing this, and it indeed is Wednesday, October 21st, there's one more day where we're leaving the registration open for Group 3 for Zooming in the Lens online course.
And it's get online and register.
Yeah, get online and register.
Look up the YouTube videos.
Yeah.
You can see what a great teacher Katrina is.
Oh, right, right.
From my perspective.
Oh, you're sweet. You're sweet. I'm in the shit with everybody there. Rolling around in it, smelling it. And then I'm just willing to be vulnerable like you were today, Kara, telling us that story. I'm really grateful you told us that story. I can feel, like, while Kara was telling us that story, what people mean when they've said to me in the past, when you tell a personal story that isn't very flattering, you are giving such a great gift to others. And I really benefited from that gift, Kara. And I benefited also from the teaching of how when I do that, even though it might feel shitty at the time, if it's something more exposing maybe than what you went through, I don't know how exposing that made you feel, but it really is a great teaching to teach from that place of vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing things slightly different just for me sharing that.
Good.
So thank you for that. And absolutely. Thank you, Lexi. And I hope, because you're going to be with me for a little while, will you do another podcast with us?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Good. Well, if anybody has any
only if
topic
people
ideas,
go and register for the course, though.
Oh, yeah.
That's my catch.
Check it on the YouTube videos and up the views for us.
Do you know what? I think that's my cue to go because I think my cat is getting eaten.
Oh, I hear that.
By, yes, another cat. There's a cat out here, a stray cat we've named Satan. Because of that sound. That was pretty much it. That was the call. The call to to stop
end the game.
This podcast. The game is over. Yeah, the game is over.
Game over.
My cat. It's my cat. No, but seriously, Zooming in the Lens is functionalyogaonline.com. And you can subscribe to this podcast if you're enjoying listening to our neuroses and us navigating through it. And I want to thank Kara Evans. And I want to thank Lexi Pellegrino for sharing all of this with us. And there's one more day to register for Zooming in the Lens. And if you're digging what you're hearing here, it's just a really, really intense participatory experience with Zooming in the Lens. And I would love for you to join us. And I'm sure we'll do many more groups. And to register, it's ramdas, that's two S's, .org/Zooming, ZOOMING. So we'll be back, and thanks for joining us on Zooming in the Lens.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I personally do not believe the purpose of life is to reach an endpoint of any kind whatsoever, human life or any other kind of life. If you look at the universe never reaches an endpoint. You can say, well, we have the Milky Way, that's an endpoint, and we have the Andromeda Galaxy, that's an endpoint, but it's not, because these two are merging.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be a new galaxy, super galaxy. And in the same way, what I see life is a process of unfolding, and each moment of life gives us an imperative about the next step. And so when your grief came up, the imperative was to work with it, to go into it and to explore it and to see where it wanted to lead you. And where it led you was into an amazing place. But then, of course, there's the next moment and the next project. Yeah. Life is a constant unfolding. And I think our, you know, when Buddhists teach about ego, egolessness, what they're really saying is that there is no fixed point in our lives, nor should there be, that life is a process of constant, constant unfolding. It's life and death and life and death and life and death. Even psychologically, we know that we go through cycles. And, you know, I think a lot of times people think the up cycle is really, that's it, and that's where they want to be. But if you meditate a lot, you realize the down cycle is so important because it leads to a new and more integrated up cycle. There's been a lot of research into the teenage brain, as I'm sure you know. You probably interviewed people. And one of the fascinating things, we have a 15-year-old teenager boy, and one of the fascinating things is he dysregulates, meaning he goes into a down cycle. He fragments. He comes apart. He falls apart. He has emotional upheavals. And then he re-regulates, and it happens like three or four times a day. And the research is that that's how they grow. That's what growth is. It's the light and the dark. It's the pain and the pleasure, the happiness and the sorrow going through night and day cycles.
Yes.
And I think that's what all of life is. And I wouldn't be that surprised. Nobody really knows. But I wouldn't be that surprised if it continues through death and beyond. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Thanks for joining us for Zooming in the Lens. If you'd like more information on Ian Hatton for music or editing, please go to mixforpicks.com. If you'd like information on buying Rena Joy's book, There Are No Secrets, please send an email to renajoy@optonline.net. She's also available for phone and Skype readings. You could also shoot me an email at zitlcourse@gmail.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you soon.